6. It was an intense hum of intent men in the room of the old mining town near the lode. Several groups were hard at work. It had amused the Scots very much to take over the offices of the Empire Dauntless Mining Corporation. The building had been almost intact, and, when cleaned up, made an acceptable operations room. Johnny half suspected that somebody had rebuilt the town after the lead load mine had played out. It was too unlike other towns. He tried to figure out why anyone would reconstruct a town after its ore was gone, but evidence certainly showed someone had. Next door was a place called the Bucket of Blood Saloon that the parson had gravely put off limits. It still had its glasses and mirrors intact, and paintings of nearly nude dancing girls and cupids could dimly be made out. Across the street was an office labeled Wells Fargo, and another one labeled Jail. They all lived in the London Palace Elite Hotel, which had labeled suites named after men who must have been famous in mining. Three of the old widows queened it over the coal-burning galley Angus had explained to them. It had running water. Luxury. The Empire Dauntless offices contained what must have been working models of the mine, and they had found history pamphlets in it that talked about the good old wild days of a boom camp and bad men. Also, curious little leaflets that said tour schedules and had a daily time and place scheduled for a bank holdup. Paintings of prospectors and mine discoverers and bad men had been cleaned off and put back on the walls. Robert the Fox and two pilots were studiously going over possible plans to hijack an ore freighter. They had no craft that could possibly fly to Scotland or Europe, for their mine equipment could only go a few hundred miles. They had been going around and around this problem ever since the night the demon had told them about bomber drones. They felt they had a responsibility to alert not only the Scots, but other peoples they might find traces of. They dared not alert the cyclos they were up to anything. To intercept in the air, leaving the cyclos to believe the freighter had gone down over the sea, was the only thing they kept coming up with. But to silence the cyclo pilot radio, to board a freighter plane to plane in midair, were some of the things they couldn't work out. Another group, two of the leaders who were off shift with Thor and Dunaldine and some of the miners, were going over mining progress. They had gotten down to the lode and were drifting along it inch by inch toward the cliff. The quartz they were taking out was pure and beautiful, but it had no gold in it. Johnny had explained to them, from references, that it was a lode with pockets. Wire gold veins only had pockets of gold every few hundred feet. It was not continuous valuable ore. They were getting tired of mining pure white quartz with no gold to show for it. They were trying to figure out how close they were to the fissure in the cliff. It had widened a tiny amount, which worried them. The historian, Dr. McDermott, was off by himself, chair tilted against a wall, reading industriously from things his scout had lately brought in from a collapsed school library in a little mining town. Johnny, Angus, the parson, and the schoolmaster were clustered over the parson's sketch of the valley. The positions of the live radiation points were in a line. At first, Johnny had thought it might be a vein of uranite popping to the surface at intervals, but the points were too regular. "They are roughly 100 feet apart," said Johnny, "in a straight line." They were staring at the map, thinking, when Dr. McDermott came over.
"It's something funny I've got here, McTyler," said the historian, shaking his book. "The Chinko guidebook was mistaken about the Air Force Academy."
Johnny shrugged. They often said things just to please the cyclos.
"But they called the Academy a primary defense base."
"I know," said Johnny. "They wanted it to sound big because it was the last battle fought on the planet."
"But there was a primary defense base," said the historian, shaking the book he held.
Johnny looked at it. It was Regulations Regarding and Governing the Evacuation of School Children in the Event of Atomic War, Department of Civil Defense.
Apparently, said the historian, the children were to be kept in school until the town mayor was flown out of the city. Here it is. And that all orders thereafter shall be issued from the primary defense base.
But we don't know where that was, said Johnny. The old man scuttled back to his pile of books.
Yes, we do.
He came back with a volume concerning congressional hearings into cost overruns of military budgets. McDermott opened the volume to where he had marked it. He read,
Question by Senator Aldrich. The Secretary of Defense then freely admits that the overrun of $1.6 billion in the construction of the primary defense base in the Rocky Mountains was incurred without congressional authority. Is that correct, Mr. Secretary?
McDermott showed Johnny and slapped the book shut.
So the Chinkos were wrong while they were being right. There was a primary defense base, and it was in the Rocky Mountains.
He smiled primly and started back to his chair. Johnny went very still. The tomb. The iron doors. The dead troops on the stairs. The tomb. Dr. Mack, Johnny called. Come back here. He showed him the sketch. You told us a story once about a line of nuclear mines laid by the Queen's Own Highlanders from Dumbarton to Falkirk. The historian nodded. He was looking at the sketch.
Did you find some wrecked remains of cyclotanks?
He said. No, said Johnny. But look, this line goes exactly across the exit from the pass from the lower plains. They're exactly spaced. They're in an exact straight line.
But with no tanks, said the parson.
They never exploded, said Johnny. Time just made them fall apart.
How did you guess this? Said the historian.
Johnny smiled. It was a little bit hard to speak. He indicated the sketch to cover his surge of emotion. After a moment, he said, That pass leads up from the western plain to the meadow. And behind that meadow, there's a canyon that goes up into the mountains. And way up that canyon is the primary defense base of the ancient government of man. He filled in the rest of the sketch. Other groups had sensed something was happening. They began drifting over. Johnny felt like crying. He swallowed hard. I wondered where they sent all the uranium they'd mined. I knew it must be somewhere. The parson touched his arm, not wanting him to run into a future failure with a crash.
They would not have had it in the base, laddie.
But the base records will tell us where it is, said Johnny. It would have maps, wires of communication. I know we'll crack this there. Angus had been staring at the sketch.
Ooh, he was saying to himself. Landmines, and I was just going to burrow in.
Robert the Fox was already gathering up those in charge to begin their expedition to the tomb. The historian was diving for references that would tell them the perils of entering tombs.
Don't fret, laddie,
said the parson to Johnny, who was just sitting there staring.
Dawning will tell us if it's true.
Chapter 10 1 The doors were cracked open just as he had left them so many years ago. Lying there, crusted with snow, but just where he had dropped it, was the iron bar he had used to open the doors. The smell might or might not be there, for he was now wearing an air mask. They had left just as soon as they could see to fly, and Johnny had spotted them down accurately just before the door. Behind him in the canyon, the Scots were unloading gear. The plane would have to leave, and they would have to obliterate all tracks with snow before the recon drone came over on its daily round. The calm voice of Robert the Fox was directing them.
Have you got the lamps? Check out the spare air bottles. Where is Daniel? Easy with those explosives.
A Scot came up with a sledgehammer to open the door wider, and Angus rushed over and pushed him aside.
No, no, no. 'Tis just wanting a bit of penetrating oil.
Angus was popping the bottom of an oil can. His voice sounded muffled through the air mask. They were all getting air masks on. The historian had found it was very unhealthy to enter tombs. Something called spores sometimes came off bone dust of the long dead and made a man cough his lungs out.
"Mind if I slip in first, Johnny?" said Angus.
Johnny took his shoulder pack so Angus could slide through. The mine lamp played on the interior.
"Ugh, enough dead men."
His oil can was popping on hinges.
"Try it, Johnny."
Johnny put his shoulder to the doors and they swung back, shooting a blast of light down the stairs. Angus had stepped out of the way and was now waiting on littered corpses, puffs of bone dust rising around his boots. They all stood for a moment, looking down the steps, awed. On this graveyard of a planet, they were no strangers to dead remains. They lay in structures and basements in abundance wherever there was any protection from wild animals or the weather, corpses more than 1,000 years dead. But reaching down this long flight of stairs were the remains of several hundred men, protected from the air until 12 years ago. Their clothing, arms, and equipment were somewhat preserved, but the bones had gone to powder.
"They fell forward," said Robert the Fox. "Must have been a regiment marching in. See? These two fellows at the top of the steps must have been closing the doors."
"The gas," said Johnny. "They opened the doors to let the regiment in, looks like, and the gas hit them from the canyon."
"Wipe the place out," said Robert the Fox. "Listen, all of you. Don't go in there without a tight air mask."
"We ought to bury these men," said the parson. "They each have little tags on them."
He picked one up.
"Nolans, Peter, Private, USMC, number 35473524, blood type B."
"Marines," said the historian. "We've got a military base here, all right."
"Do you suppose," said the parson to Johnny, "that village of yours could once have been a marine base? It is different than other towns."
"The village has been rebuilt 12 times, said Johnny. "Robert, let's go in."
"Remember your priorities," said Robert to the group. "Inventory only. Don't touch records until they're identified. This is a big place. Don't stray or get lost."
"We ought to bury these bodies," said the parson.
We will, said Robert. "All in good time. Gunners, forward. Flush out and destroy any animals."
5 Scots carrying submachine guns raced down the steps, alert for bears or snakes in hibernation, or stray wolves.
"Ventilation team, stand by," said Robert,
and glanced over his shoulder to make sure the 3 assigned to carry the heavy mine ventilation fans were there and ready. There was an uneven burst of fire below. The sub-Thompson ammunition was dud 2 rounds out of 5, and to get a sustained burst, one had to recock the bolt in mid-fire. Robert's small, limited-range radio crackled,
"Rattlesnakes, 4, all dead, end com."
"Aye,"
said Robert the Fox into the mic.